Good evening and welcome to the Wiseman Art Museum at the University of Minnesota. I'm Colleen Sheehy. I'm Director of Education here at the Wiseman. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight. Our speaker tonight, Bruce Schneier, said that he's filled rooms around the world talking about security issues, and he was right. Tonight, he's talking about the theater of security, as he calls it. And this program is one of the events that we've organized with our current exhibition, Paul Schambroom, Picturing Power, which will be on view through April 20th. If you've seen the exhibition, you'll know that Paul Schambroom has photographed power in a number of ways. And if you haven't been into the exhibit, I hope that you will make a point of getting in. Paul has shown us how power is embedded in the architectural spaces in which we work, with their implications of the power wielded within corporations and with their hierarchical structures, as seen in his offices and factory series. He's shown us how power appears in the theatrical, if humble, settings in which citizens of small towns meet to deliberate laws and policies, as seen in his series called Meetings. And he documents what seem to be, at first, what we might think of as secret settings in government projects built to assure safety and security, as in his nuclear weapons series and his latest one that's just simply called Security. Schambroom shows us in this latest series the kind of training and rehearsals that are underway today for the United States to prepare for possible terrorist acts. These last images evoke conflicting emotions among many viewers, sometimes conflicting emotions in single individuals. Should these rehearsals make us feel safe or fearful? Well, tonight you'll hear from someone who is going to help us think about these issues and not only to feel about security. He's the author of Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly About Security in an Uncertain World. And I want to thank Bruce Schneier for appearing at the Wiseman to enlighten us on this very critical issue. It was Paul Schambroom who recommended that we try to get Bruce Schneier to speak. He had heard Bruce on some radio programs and was familiar with some of his books. So we were really delighted to discover that he actually lives here in the Twin Cities, and he generously agreed to appear at the Wiseman. You'll hear more about him and his work soon. But before you hear that, I want to acknowledge our collaborators and co-sponsors on this program, the University's Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs and its Alumni Association. And I want to thank especially Camille Gage and Michelle Potter for working alongside me, Jill Boldenow, and Paula Kittleson at the Wiseman. And then I also want to thank our funders who have supported the entire Paul Schambroom project. That includes the Andy Warhol Foundation for Visual Art and the National Endowment for the Arts. And then I want to invite you to stay after the program. We'll have Bruce speak and then a lively question and answer period, I'm sure. And then we'll have a reception outside in the gallery next door with food and drink. So stay on and we can continue our conversations. And then there's also more. There are more programs coming up with Paul Schambroom, and those are detailed in our newsletter that you can pick up at the information desk. We also have, if you get really fired up about issues tonight, I especially invite you to come back on Thursday, April 17th, when Harry Boyd from the University's Center for Democracy and Citizenship will be speaking about how to save democracy in the 21st century. And he's a worldwide expert on those issues. Now to hear more about Bruce Schneier, I want to introduce Misty Hegenis, who's with the Humphreys Alumni Association. Thank you.
I can never hear my own intros. Because they're always embarrassing.
All right, on that note. Welcome, and thank you for coming out tonight. It's a glorious, sunny evening, so we're glad that all of you decided to come here and listen to our speaker tonight. I'm going to give you a brief introduction for Bruce Schneier. Bruce Schneier is an internationally renowned security technologist and author, described by The Economist as a security guru. His first bestseller, Applied Cryptography, explained how the arcane science of secret codes actually works, and was described by Wired as the book the National Security Agency wanted never to be published. His book on computer and security network, Secrets and Lies, was called by Fortune magazine a jewel box of little surprises you can actually use. His current book, Beyond Fear, tackles the problems of security from the small to the large, including personal safety, crime, corporate security, and national security. And with that, please join me in welcoming Bruce Schneier.
So security is really two different things, right? It's a feeling and it's a reality. And they're very different, right? You can feel secure even though you're not, and you can be secure even though you don't feel it. Right? In a sense, we have two different concepts mapped onto the same word. And actually, in a lot of this talk, we're going to find the language really doesn't serve us well. But there are a lot of different things going on when we talk about the word security. I think one of the problems with discussing it in society today is that we're often talking about different things and we're having conversations. So this is really a talk about trying to reconceptualize what security it means, trying to separate the feeling from the reality, trying to look at when the two converge, how they diverge, what happens, how we can bring them together. You know, we're going to try to invent some new language, but, you know, we'll find again and again that it's hard. So for now, sort of keep in mind that, how do we go next? Right, there's a feeling and there's a reality. Right, two separate things. So the traditional economic view of anything, so of security, is that it's a trade-off. Right? There's no such thing as absolute security. And any security you get is going to involve some sort of trade-off. Right? You give away something and you get some cost. Right? And this is cost in the general economic sense. It could be money, it could be time, it could be attention, convenience, you know, liberties, anything you might give up to get security. Right? All security involves some sort of trade-off. I remember in the weeks after December 11th, I was talking to the press on the phone, and I was asked, you know, how can we prevent this from ever happening again? And I said, well, that's easy. Just ground all the aircraft. Right? You laugh, but in the hours after the attacks, that's exactly what we did. Right? During that time, when we didn't know what was going on, we didn't know the extent of the attacks, the extent of the plot, what was happening, an extreme security trade-off was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and something today we'd never even consider. Right? So these trade-offs are not always obvious. They're kind of subtle. When I was a kid living in New York, I had relatives who lived in a gated community, which means it's a little block of houses that had a fence and a guard. Right? And they traded some freedom of movement for some security. And so security always involves a trade-off. And the question you ask is not whether something makes you more secure, right, but whether it's a good trade-off, right? Whether it's a good use of your security expense. And I'm going to give you an easy example. None of us are wearing bulletproof vests here. It's not because they don't work. They work great. It's because of us living in 2008 Minneapolis, the cost in money and, I don't know, loss of fashion sense, and whatever it is we'll be trading off isn't worth it. Right? And these trade-offs are personal. There's not really a right and wrong here. Right? Some of us are more risk-averse. Some of us are willing to take more risks. Some of us might be willing to take risks in different situations. You know, whether you have a burglar alarm at home will depend on, you know, what neighborhood you live in, how much good stuff you have, whether you live alone or with a family. I mean, a lot of reasons why you'd make that trade-off. Now, people have a natural intuition about these trade-offs. It's something we do every day, multiple times a day. You know, when we're driving and we, swerve to avoid something, or we're walking at night and we don't like this street, you walk down a different street. Or, you know, you walk into a restaurant and you say, this doesn't really look right, I'm going to go elsewhere. You know, if you're traveling, and whether you block your, double lock your hotel room door. I mean, these are all trade-offs we make. As we go through our life, most of the time we don't even realize it. They're so intuitive, right? It's so fundamental to being alive. Everybody does it. Every species does it. Right? You imagine a rabbit in a field eating grass, right? And the rabbit will see a fox. And that rabbit will make a security trade-off. Should I stay or should I flee? And if you think about it, the rabbits that are good at making that trade-off will tend to live and reproduce. And the rabbits that are bad at it will either get eaten or starve. So you'd expect that as a successful species on the planet, you, I, people, would be really good at making these trade-offs. At the same time, we seem to be hopelessly bad at it. Right? And that is an interesting point. I mean, that's something worth studying. And the reason is, I mean, so I sort of give you the answer now, that we respond to the feeling of security rather than the reality of security. Right? We're responding to the feeling and not the reality. Most of the time, this works. Right? We've developed brain heuristics about risk and security. And we've developed them because they make evolutionary sense. They're basically cognitive shortcuts. Because through most of our existence, making these decisions about security had to be done quickly. Right? It's the same mechanics that the rabbit is using, we're using. Right? Most of the time, the feeling and reality are the same, or at least they were. Right? In a sense, we are superbly optimized for making the security trade-offs endemic to living in small family groups in the East African highlands at 100,000 BC. 2008 in New York, not so much. Right? Modern times are harder. So to give you sort of one intuition about this, we tend to get our notions of risk through stories. Right? Through our experience and through experience of others via stories. That's how we learn what's safe and what's dangerous. One of the things that perturbs that in modern times is the media. Not out of malice, simply by repeating the rare and the unexpected and spectacular, it feels more common in our head. I would tell people, if it's in the news, don't worry about it. Right? By definition, news means it hardly ever happens. Right? When something's no longer in the news, automobile crashes, domestic violence, right, then you worry about it. Right? When it's so common, it's not news. But that's not the way we think. We think in terms of stories. And if the story of the September 11th terrorist attacks is repeated endlessly, we feel like it happens endlessly. We feel like it happens all the time. Whereas the 42,000 United States deaths in automobile crashes every year never gets repeated, we tend to think that doesn't happen as much as it does. I mean, that's just one example. So there is work being done. It's relatively new on the psychology of security. And people interested, I have an essay on the topic. If you type psychology of security into Google, it's the first hit. And I go through a bunch of experiments about risk and security in people and making trade-offs and judging costs. It's part of, I think, a very new branch of science. We're really seeing an explosion in studies of the brain. And it's a combination of experimental psychology, behavioral economics, cognitive science, game theory, neuroscience, evolutionary biology, anthropology, sociology. All these people are coming together to study how the brains actually work. And some of it's fascinating stuff. I mean, there'll be experimenters who will put people into MRI scanners and ask them moral questions to see which part of the brain lights up. But a lot of work is being done in how human beings make decisions, process information, and there's quite a bit about risk. So I'll give you sort of some examples. I wrote down four particular biases that human beings have in risk perception. One, we tend to exaggerate the spectacular and downplay the common. Flying versus driving. Right? People are afraid to fly, not afraid to drive. Even though the math is completely the opposite. You know, if you're going on a plane flight, the taxi ride to the airport is the most dangerous part of the journey. But that's not the way people think. The unknown is perceived to be riskier than the familiar. You know, if you ask people about child kidnapping, what they're afraid of is the stranger kidnapping their child. If you look at the statistics, what you should be afraid of is a relative and not a stranger. But that's not the way we think. Personified risks are perceived to be greater than anonymous risks. Bin Laden's much scarier because he has a name. If he didn't have a name, there would be less of a story. We'd be less fearful. People also overestimate involuntary risks and underestimate risks they take willingly. So, you know, earthquakes versus smoking. If we take a risk, we tend to minimize it in our heads. But if it's a risk we can't control, earthquakes, we think of it much bigger in our heads. And those are just four examples. So what happens when the feeling and reality are out of whack? I mean, what I want is those two circles to overlap. I mean, that's what we're looking for, that our feeling matches reality. So our intuition does what's right, does what's best. Well, if the feeling is greater than the reality, right, we have a false sense of security, maybe a naive sense of security, you can call it. If the reality is greater than the fear, then we have, I guess, a false sense of insecurity. Right? In extreme cases, you can call it paranoia, but I don't think that really fits in the natural case. Right? So irrational fear, maybe. Right? Again, I mean, language isn't really good at teasing these concepts out. Right? And there are lots of security products out there that address the feeling but not the reality. It's I've called them security theater. Right? Products that make us feel better without actually doing anything. But what do you call something that addresses the reality of security but not the feeling? It's kind of like what the CIA is supposed to do, right? They're supposed to make us safer and then not tell us about it. Right? But this really isn't a name for that. So economics drives security, right? The security is, in a sense, a market. It's either a market of products or it's a market of political ideas. And if people are making trade-offs based on the feeling of security, not the reality, then what the market is going to provide us is the feeling of security, but not the reality. Right? Or the market is going to focus on the feeling because that's what the public is going to base its decisions on. Whether it's decisions on, you know, what car to buy or which candidate to support, right? Based on the feeling. So if I'm going to try to satisfy a market in the feeling of security, there are kind of two ways I can do this. I can make people more secure and hope they notice, or I can make people feel more secure and I guess hope they don't notice. Right? I can do either of those two things. Right? So now the question to ask is, what makes people notice? I mean, what makes people notice when the feeling and reality are far apart? Well, basically, an understanding does. Right? If you understand how the security works, what the threats are, what the risks are, what the limitations of the technology are, if you understand how things are working, you'll have a better understanding of the reality, so your feeling will match it closer. If there's enough information on real-world effectiveness, right, if there are enough events, so we're more likely to have those closer together when it comes to burglaries in our community, which happen at a regular rate, and we read about them in the paper or we hear about them from our neighbors, to something like, oh, I don't know, meteor strikes, right, which have happened approximately never. Right? There isn't enough data for us to have a good intuition about what the reality is. Right? Emotion can separate those two. But if people feel scared, I mean, think of flying. You know, if you're trying to cure someone of a fear of flying, giving them lots and lots of facts actually isn't a successful strategy. Right? There's too much emotion preventing the facts from getting through. So what makes people not notice? Well, a lack of understanding, right? A poor understanding of the risks. I mean, any of those biases I talked about previously. A poor understanding of costs. I mean, there are a lot of times when people don't really understand what the costs are. Some costs are hidden. I mean, a lot of the costs that we talk about in national security tend to be hidden. We don't actually see them as clearly, maybe until it's too late. Present versus future costs play into that. You know, money paid now or money paid later. You know, bad math. People are not really good at large numbers. So a risk of one in 10,000, a risk of one in the billion in our heads is basically the same. And there have been experiments done, you know, showing this, that people won't do the math properly because almost never equals almost never. Even though it might be several orders of magnitude difference between two different almost nevers. Right? And I said before, the inherent problem of low probability events. That we just don't have enough data to do the math right. And also a poor understanding of the effectiveness of different countermeasures. Right? That contributes. So, what I want to suggest is that this model is actually incomplete. That really, I want to break up what goes on in our head. That there's a reality, and that's the same. And there's an intuitive feeling, and that's the same. But there's also a cognitive model in our head. Right? So those left things are in our head. The feeling is sort of the intuition. What happens naturally? Right? Oh, heavens, I'm afraid to fly. The model is the data. I mean, the data in our head, which hopefully will give us a way to override our model. Sorry, a way to override our feeling. Now, in a primitive and simple world, the feeling is close to reality. In a modern and complex world, it's more likely that we have a model that's closer to reality. Because we have a lot of filters between us and risk these days. Right? It's not just through experience or through stories. Right? The media is really a filter that filters people's stories between, you know, reality and us. Technology is a filter. Right? The risks of bacteria cannot be directly perceived. You know, there is a scientific story that we've all accepted that explains the risks, and that becomes our model. Now, of course, there are limitations. We want that model to be close to reality. But certainly limitations of information, of technology, of science. Right? There are some things we just don't know. So you will see, you know, healthy scientific debates about, I don't know, the risks of genetic engineering. Right, because there's a lot missing from even the best models. But, you know, good science gives us better models. And as we become more facile in our environment, our feeling starts matching the model, which, of course, we hope matches reality. Right, when someone says it's intuitive, what they really often mean is that's familiar. If you read about people's reactions to electricity in the Victorian times, when it first started entering the public consciousness, we started seeing electrical things, there was a lot of fear. And there were people who were afraid to press doorbells because it was electricity and that was dangerous. Right? There was no good model to counteract those fears. I mean, we here will laugh at that. We've all had electricity since birth. And our intuition, our model, is much closer to reality right? And gives us a bit, and has dropped into intuition. Though if you talk to about the risks of computers to someone who is, you know, 60 versus someone who is 30, you'll see the difference. That people who are younger have a much more intuitive feel of the risks, right? Their model is closer to their feeling, such that the model almost becomes the feeling. Whereas someone who's older, even though they might use the model, they still have to overcome the feeling. And there are people for whom will ignore the model and only react to the feeling. Now, I mean, you see the same thing in the dangers of terrorism now. I mean, there isn't a good model that society accepts. So people tend to react based on their feelings and nothing else. And so there's one other complication I want to add. And this is the notion of agenda. Remember I said before that security trade-offs are personal? We give a home burglar alarm. So you kind of have sort of a relativistic theory of security, that it depends on the observer. That the trade-off made depends on the person making it. And many trade-offs that we make in society aren't simple, should I wear a bulletproof vest today? They're complex public policy decisions. Right? And these decisions affect multiple stakeholders. And each stakeholder will have its own perspective and his own trade-offs. So then there's a negotiation, a power negotiation. Right? What eventually becomes public policy depends on all of these different stakeholders. Remember, example, in the months after September 11th, the debate came up whether we should arm airplane pilots. And it was a fascinating debate. And you can see the different stakeholders and their agendas. The pilots kind of thought it was a good idea because carrying a gun is sort of cool. Flight attendants hated the idea because they had this story in their head of the pilot and the gun on this side of the door and them and the terrorists on that side of the door, and they hated that story because it never came out well. The airlines kept thinking, holes in my fuselage. Right? That wasn't any good. The passengers union was kind of in the middle. They didn't really take a strong stand because they didn't really have a big agenda. Everyone else considered this a national referendum on gun control and basically debated their side of that argument. And you never really saw a rational discussion of, is this a good idea? Right? Is there a model that we can build and decide whether this makes sense or not? I mean, so that's an example. So by agenda, I don't mean anything malicious or manipulative. Just that different stakeholders will evaluate security trade-offs differently. Right? And that makes sense. And also, very often security trade-offs are made for non-security reasons. You know, that would hit the news story yesterday. I mean, this is kind of an amazing story. We are outsourcing the printing of our passports to a company in Thailand. I mean, from a security perspective, this is like a really dumb idea, but think of the savings. Right? Security trade-offs are often made for non-security reasons. So you can look at different agendas. I mean, if you sort of, and so let's go through some sort of basic stakeholders. The agenda of government, in general, is overestimating, not underestimating. I mean, government has a predilection for doing something. Right? You're likely to vote for the guy who does something. So you very often get sort of the logic, something must be done, this is something, therefore let's do it. Right? I mean, that does happen. You see a lot of things that make minimal sense because it's doing something. And if you think about it, just think about terrorism, the guy that says, let's do all these things, right? And someone else says, no, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. Let's not do that. So when the next terrorist attack happens, right, you know, this guy tried to make you safe. This guy didn't even think the threat was real. If no terrorist attack happens, this guy prevented it from happening. Right? He gets to take credit either way. So there is a government predilection for doing something, right? For doing more, not for minimizing the threat. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Right? In a police department, there's a predilection, you know, strangely enough, for police state-like security measures. Not because the police are evil, not because they're malicious, not because they're out to take over the world, but because if you are a policeman, from your perspective, having everybody keep their hands where you can see them is a really good idea. So you see pushes for measures of large-scale surveillance and identification. Because those are the sorts of things, if you are the police, makes your job easier. Right? And those are the trade-offs you're willing to make, even though society as a whole might not. Right? The agenda of corporations is, of course, to maximize profits. Right? Security trade-offs become business trade-offs. Right? So outsourcing passport printing to Thailand is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Right? Even though it might not make sense from a more narrow perspective. And the agenda of the people, of most people, of us, is the feeling of security. We want to feel more secure. That's what we want. So what you have, because you have these agendas and these negotiations, is that stakeholders with agendas try to manipulate in the model. Right? And that's marketing, and that's politics. Right, stakeholders try to convince people to trust their feelings and ignore a scientific model. Right, you know, marginalizing experts. We're seeing a lot of that in politics today. Or convincing people to have a faulty model. Right, if I'm trying to sell, and you can go buy this, you know, a home kit to survive nuclear terrorism, I've got to convince you that you need it. And that means to convince you either to have a faulty model or to ignore any realistic model. And it's sort of what ends up happening, and this is sort of unfortunate, is that people end up more scared. Because I have to make you very scared, then I sell you the kit that'll make you a little less scared, but I'm still leaving you more scared than you started. Right? So there's attempts to manipulate people's feelings to be more fearful and then trying to alleviate that fear. So you have a lot of security theater, designed as theater. I mean, the companies that sell cameras try very hard to make people believe that cameras will make them safer. Right? And our natural feeling is, well, yeah, if there are cameras, we'll be safer. I mean, it sounds right. But the data shows the opposite. That data can be hard to get out, right? Because it contradicts your feelings. And there's deliberate manipulation for it not to come out. So how do you fix this? Right? I mean, what do we do here to make this better? Well, basically, information is how to fix it. I mean, let's take a look at the business world. Right? There are risks in business, and companies take them or not. Right? They build security measures or not. Right? This is part of business. Information is how this fixes itself. Right? There's a natural convergence of those three circles with enough real information. Right? You know, capitalism is sort of natural selection applied to business at a much, much tighter time frame. So the companies whose, you know, individual feelings match a model they construct or they accept from science or wherever it's given to them that matches reality will tend to make smarter trade-offs. They will survive. They're more likely to survive in a business world. So with information, those three things tend to converge. Right? There is still the optimism bias to worry about. You know, one of the cognitive biases is documented is people tend to believe that good stuff will happen to them and bad stuff will happen to other people. Right? You know, it's those other drunk drives we have to worry about kind of thinking. You know, it's very common. And you still have to deal with the problem of rare events where you just don't have a lot of information. And you have to trust your model. But again, companies that do will tend to do better. Right. In the individual world, this is harder. In 100,000 BC, we all had the expertise to evaluate any model. Right? If there was a model of tiger attacks in our village, we'd sort of know if they worked or not. If it made sense. But in modern society, for many of the risks, we lack the expertise to understand them. So we have to rely on one of two things, right? You have to rely on others to provide us with a model. Or our feelings, our intuition, which could very well be faulty. You can think of this about things big like global warming. Or you can think of this as something small, whether a particular drug is effective or not. In prescription drugs, we all rely on somebody else's expertise. We walk into a doctor's office, and they prescribe us something with a very long and funny name that we've probably never heard of, but we rely on those doctors' expertise. We don't even know what his model is. We often don't care. That we're just sort of delegating our ability to make a security trade-off to him, and that's why we pay him. Or in other instances, we trust our feelings. I don't care what the data says. I'm afraid to fly. Right? And that makes it harder. Some of the solution is time. Right? Especially with technological risks, people need to become familiar enough with the systems to accept the model. Right? Think of electricity over the past 150 years. Or computer risks today, which, the model is still changing. Right? There we have a problem that the model changes very quickly, often too quick for us to assimilate on a human scale. So we're sort of stuck in a world where convergence might not happen, right? Where feeling and model might stay far apart, where model is constantly chasing reality. Because reality is changing. The whole weapons of mass destruction debate is about the model chasing reality. Right? And the model is, sort of how much damage can, 10 angry men do before they're subdued. And throughout history, there was some number, and it was, some small amount. And whether you accept that it's possible today or in 10 years or 20 years, eventually it's going to become a large amount. Right? And we don't really have models for that yet. So a lot of that debate was very hard to have because people were dealing with their feelings and there was no good model. Anytime someone had a model, it was very slippery because it would change based on information and also based on what time horizon you're looking at. But information really is our best hope for convergence. Information and the feeling that lets us accept the expert's model. Right? Trust in the science for risks we cannot perceive directly. Like global warming because it's just too slow. It doesn't happen on our normal cognitive time scale. Or bacteria because it's too small. I guess they're asteroid attacks because they're too large. Right? For these things, we need to trust an expert model, or become experts ourselves. But what's interesting is that the feeling and the reality and the model are all important. When I started working in security, I tended to deride the feeling in favor of reality. But what's really important is how close they are. Right? That's what's important. Right, and security systems need to address both. I don't know if you remember, after September 11th, when they were in the airports, there were National Guard troops in the airports. Do you remember that? They were standing just inside of the checkpoints, and they're sitting on rubber mats and uniforms that had these big-looking guns. Those guns had no bullets. Right? Probably the best, because they were like 20. But, right, so that was pure security theater. Right? He was there to make you feel better, pretty much for no other reason. But if you think about how most people felt in the months of September 11th, a little bit of feeling better, it was just the thing we needed. Now, another story, people remember the Tylenol poisonings in the mid-80s. People who are too young to remember that. There was sort of a rash of these, and someone would take a bottle of Tylenol, some other non-prescription drug, take it home, put poison in it, and put it back on the shelf. Happened, not for a lot, but a few times. It made the news. It was you know, random horrific. And people were afraid to buy non-prescription drugs over the counter, right, for fear of being poisoned. Right, pretty much never happens, but you know, the media made it a big thing. So what Tylenol did was they invented something called a tamper-proof cap. And this is where the tamper-proof cap industry came from, came out of this. And it saved the prescription, non-prescription drug market. Right? It's very much security theater as sort of a take-home exercise. You can come up with 10 ways to defeat it. I'll give you one, a syringe. Right? It's not hard. Right? But it made people feel better. What it did is it made people's feeling of security closer match reality. Right? Gave them a new model, right? It was new technology that they were able to transfer to their feeling. And it made those three things converge, even though it didn't really move reality very much. It moved the other things. But in that system, they're the ones that needed moving. Right? There are other systems, automobile crashes, domestic violence, where moving reality is very important. And in fact, we have very good models. Right? So our goal will be to move reality and feeling closer to the model. Right? To bring those risks actually down. So the goal of this talk was to give people sort of other language and other ways of thinking about security. Right? That it's not just one thing, it's not even two things, it's actually three things. Right? And how they interact, right? How much convergence there is, how they diverge, which one you want to move when they diverge, who might want to make them diverge and how, is something I think we all need to be cognizant of. You know, that we're living in a world today where security reality is changing. We're living in a world today where politics is very much centered on how we feel about security and what models we use. And how we approach our future will very much be dependent on those three things. So that's the talk, and I'm happy to take questions. So rumor has it there's a microphone, and it's right there, which will be handed to people.
We are recording this.
This is being recorded. So you can either state your name or not, or speak in a funny voice or not.
I kind of like to know what you feel about how we should perceive global warming. The interesting thing was Michelle Bachmann article in the newspaper yesterday that she's trading off the insecurity of possible mercury contamination for the fact that we're killing the planet, in my opinion. So wondered what your take on that is.
Well, there actually is serious debate on what to do. I mean, the debate isn't whether it's a problem. There are scientists who say that solving some of the near-term problem, I mean, again, it's the trade-off. We have limited resources, limited money. What should we spend it on? And is it smarter, you know, to wait 5-10 years for better technology and deal with some of the near-term problems first? I'm kind of surprised Bachmann's saying this because this is surprisingly smart for her. So maybe she's spoken to somebody. But right, there is real debate on how to deal with the problem and whether it makes sense to take our resources and deal with some of the things we can make a difference on and we know we can and let technology catch up to where we can make a better difference on global warming or whether they have to approach that now. You know, this is not my area of expertise. There really is scientific debate on what the model is. It's very political, right? There's a lot of feeling about this. Oh, this isn't true. Oh, this can't be right. Oh, this is a hoax. Right? That's deliberate rejection of a scientific model in favor of feeling. mostly made for non-security reasons, right? Mostly made for political reasons and other reasons. So there's a lot going on in global warming. It's made harder because the effects of it cannot be felt in probably a normal lifetime, though it seems to be that might not be true. But certainly, it's not the extremes you worry about, it's the average change. And we as human beings notice extremes. Right? Oh, it was a cold winter this year. Oh, it was a warm winter this year. Right? That kind of stuff isn't what's important. But, the average date that something happens over the course of a 100 years is what matters. I don't know if I answered that.
Well, you have me thinking a little bit differently about two things that I think that we're going through right now that are very much theater of security, and one of them is the wall and other technology solutions to our borders, and the other one is airport security. So I'm willing to accept that some of this is about creating a feeling of security, but I happen to personally think that the cost is pretty high. So what kind of information would we as citizens want our policymakers to have or to specifically look for to determine where the trade-off, what's the appropriate level of trade-off there?
Well, I guess the most important thing we can tell our policymakers is that we're okay with risk. I mean, one of the best campaigns I've ever seen to deal with this. I forget which group does this, but it's sort of getting people to write the legislatures and say that we know that life itself is risk, and absolute security isn't what we want, and stop trading away sort of everything that makes our society great in the name of security. We don't want to do that. To tell policymakers, I mean, that's what they need to know, because for them, it's not about the facts. It's about getting reelected. Right? And they will do what they believe their constituents want, what they can convince their constituents to want. I mean, and they will do the things that make sense from their agenda, from their perspective. You know, airport security, I mean, airport security is a sort of interesting microcosm, because you have the story. I mean, we are really good at defending against what the bad guys did last week. And airport security is a great example of that. And if you think about it, right, we take away guns and knives, so they use box cutters, and we confiscate box cutters and corkscrews, and they put explosives in their shoes. So we screen shoes, and they use liquids. We take away liquids. They're going to do something else, right? This is a dumb game. Let's stop playing it. But it's a game that if you are in policy, you must play, because it's the cover-your-ass game. Because, in fact, if the bad guys do the same thing again, you screwed up. If they did something new, you didn't know it was coming. So if you are in charge of airport security, defending against what the bad guys did last week is your job. You will be fired otherwise. So it's not about information. It's really about agenda. And if we expect, and I think this will happen, within 10, 15 years. Airports are going to get back to something reasonable. You know, the pendulum will swing the other way. It always does. It'll be because we are less fearful, not because of more information. And the same thing with border security. I mean, this sort of this myth that we can take, whatever thousands of miles of border and put a wall around it and somehow magically make the country secure is completely ridiculous. But there is this feeling of, right, they're coming up from the south and they're going to get us. And as long as there is that fear, right, not based on reality, not based on facts, based on a story, based on a faulty model, you are going to get solutions like, well, put a wall up. Duh. Right? I mean, that's the reaction. What you need to make that stop is, a wall, that's dumb. And unfortunately, that's the kind of level of debate.
If everybody has different agendas, could it be that people will need different models for the same convergence with reality?
Not really. I mean, because what you want is the model to best match reality. So agenda doesn't mean the facts are different. Agenda just means your trade-off is different. For example, I am much more happy to have a burglar alarm in my house if someone else will pay for it. Right? So, you know, my agenda might be different. I mean, the effectiveness of the alarm system is the same. But if I make a different trade-off, remember Oliver North who had a burglar alarm paid by somebody else? Right? I mean, sure. I mean, that's okay. Someone else is buying it. That's great. For something like also burglar alarms. You know, whether I have, you know, expensive stuff in my house, whether I have a family or live alone, what neighborhood I live in. None of these affect the model. This is just additional data that go into my particular trade-off. So models work best when they converge with reality. Right? Different data enters the model, and we all make our trade-off based on that. You know, some of us might be more risk-averse than others. Right? Some of us might jump out of airplanes and parachute. Some of us might not. We all should have the same stats about how safe it is. And then we'll make a different trade-off. So I think models work best when they converge with reality.
Oh, hi. I was wondering, what are the theoretical underpinnings for your work in security, especially democratic theories and models?
So I come from technology. So my work is in computer security, network security, system security. And I've moved, and sort of my career has been an endless series of generalizations. I started out in math and then moved into computers and networks, into general technological systems like voting systems and ID cards, I mean, mainly because they all use computers. And a lot of my recent work, my previous book, took a lot of the methodologies we learned in the computer field and applied them in broader contexts. So airline security, home security, national security, the same sorts of ways of thinking from one domain work in others. The past few years, I've been generalizing again, looking at first the economics of security, right, and all of the economic modeling, and just trying to pull people, into this technological mix. And for the past year, I've been doing most of my reading on the psychology of security, and sort of all those branches I mentioned before, both the experimental psychologists, the neuroscience, the evolutionary biologists are doing a lot in this area, and trying to synthesize this into sort of a way of looking at security that works across the spectrum. And it's interesting. I mean, it's the same cognitive processes whether we're making a split second decision to run away from the mean looking dog, than if we make a very long and reasoned decision on whether to invade a foreign country or not. It's the same brains doing the same thing. One's faster than the other. And a lot of work is done in neuroscience, in the different parts of the brain that get involved. It's fascinating reading the work done in evolutionary psychology, evolutionary biology. Our brains have evolved over a long time to do all sorts of things really well. And there's a part of our brain called the amygdala, and it's sort of just north of the brainstem. First evolved in primitive fishes. This is the part of the brain that feels fear. And when you have the fight or flight reflex, the sweaty palms, an increased pulse rate, increased muscle tension, that's the amygdala. And you can show people snakes who are fearful of snakes, and their amygdala will kick in before their consciousness registers what they've seen. Right? You're scared before you know what you're scared at. So the part of the brain that's here, the frontal lobe, the neocortex, that evolved in humans, right? That is the uniquely human part of the brain, is constantly trying to sort of batten down the primitive brain and saying, "Just relax. It's a picture of a snake. It's not a real snake." When you were a fish, there were no pictures of snakes. Right? If it looked like a snake, it was a snake, and you're leaving. Right? But our neocortex knows better. And there are lots of examples of that. Yes?
I think that's a good segue into the question I have, because one of the things you talked about, and I was hoping you'd put it up there on the model and didn't see you do it, the agenda tends to focus on feelings rather than on the models. And what you're saying,
right,
the solution to the problem is for the models to map to reality a little better and get comfortable with it.
Right, a lot better. I mean, I want those two to overlap is what I want.
Right. But the fact of the matter is what we deal with most of the time in society has to do more with agendas, which has more to do with moving feelings in any direction, whether it's towards or away from reality, is almost irrelevant to what you're describing in terms of the sense of security. So talk a little bit more about how the agenda and information can work together, because it seems like agendas have a better footing
information. But only when there isn't a model that has moved close to our feeling. For example, I'm going to have a lot of trouble making you scared of electricity, right? Because our model is so close to our feeling. Right? The model that's accurate is so close to feeling that trying to move your feeling away from the model isn't going to work because you're so comfortable with it. It's the stuff that's new where the model we've just heard about, we're tentative with it. There's scientific debate on the model. Right? It hasn't become a social norm. Right? Those are the ones where you either see deliberate feeling manipulation because there's no model to sort of anchor to, or deliberate model manipulation. Right? You know, think of the risks of smoking as a great example of that, and how that, and you can sort of map the changes in our lifetime, or at least some people's lifetimes, right? From the, it's perfectly safe and doctors recommend it, to, it'll kill you, but I don't care. Right? I mean, and everybody moved from there to there. Right? And the smoking industry tried very hard, right, to cloud the model, to manipulate the feelings, and they did different things over different times, depending on sort of where we as society were, moving from, right, new risk to risk we understand and take willingly. So it's not all obvious that people kick around one versus the other. It depends on what the risk is.
In one of the Orlando newspapers, there was an article. They're about ready to roll out a surveillance camera system for downtown Orlando, and they were touting the Minneapolis surveillance camera system as an example.
Well, that explains why I got a press call on that today.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
I was wondering.
And they're touting the wonderful statistics from Minneapolis that crime is way down here and 100% prosecution rates from our camera system. And yet we've seen nothing in our press here that I've seen, at least.
I'm willing to bet those numbers are not right.
And wondering if you could, talk a little bit about surveillance systems and numbers that people are throwing around out there when they're selling these systems,
right,
to communities.
And selling is important, right? Because there is definitely an agenda here, right? If you are selling cameras, the model you want to put forward is sort of the intuitive one, that if there's a camera, there'll be no bad guys because bad guys don't want to get on cameras. Right? I mean, this sort of makes sense. A lot of the data doesn't bear that out. The most recent stat I saw came out of San Francisco. And it's just last week. I'm going to blog it in a few days because it's in the queue, which showed that it doesn't really have much of an effect. Cameras seem to move crime around at best. Right? No one says, oh, look, there's a camera, I'll go get a real job. Right? I gave you another model, right? Right. This is the game you have to play. Right. And at best, cameras seem to move crime around. London's the best example. They are the most camera-happy city on the planet.
Come with me, I'll mug you over here.
Or they wait till you walk over there. I mean, and most camera footage isn't useful in prosecution. Surprising. You'd expect it would be, but it tends not to be.
If I got mugged, can I go request?
Generally not. Sometimes it shows up, most time you can't. But again, it depends on who you are. Let's go back to agenda. If you run a 7-Eleven and you put a camera in your store and the burglar goes and robs the place next door, that's a win. Right? If you are the township, that is a waste of money. Right? Agenda matters. For some people, moving crime around, I mean, the reason you get a burglar alarm is not to make the criminal go home, it's to make him rob the next door neighbor. Right? That's why you have a burglar alarm. So for some agendas, cameras make sense. Right? At the very local level, right, they tend to. But at the larger level, the city level, they generally don't. But you know what makes a difference in parking lots is lighting and cameras. You know, that's what they, I mean, you are worried about violence in parking lots at night, lighting and cameras, that makes a difference. I mean, that is undisputable. I mean, or equally undisputable is you put them all over town, they're not going to do any good.
Hi, yeah. I just want to, I think the idea of voting systems is an extremely base level important subject for, you know, it's how we elect who makes any other decision. And I was just wondering if you could talk about it relative to the models that you have up here.
Voting systems are interesting because it's become very political. Because, you know, it a lot of the discussion about voting in our country is thinly veiled voter suppression discussion. Right? And it's not about voting machines or registration or who's allowed or IDs. It's about suppressing certain votes, certain voters in favor of other voters. That's unfortunate. Right, because you'd like to think that accuracy is more important than your side winning, and long term I think it is. I mean, when you have an election, it is especially in a democracy where they actually matter. It's important that at the end of the election, both sides, the winner and the loser, say, "Yep, that was right." Right, that's really important for the peaceful transition of power. You cannot have a democracy survive where the loser side says that was rigged. As we see, you know, in many countries around the globe again and again. So even if there is no manipulation, if there is the perception of, the likelihood of, the chance of, the belief of, the belief, right, the acceptance of the accuracy of the election is suddenly a problem. So I think it's very important. And there's a lot I could talk about with the technology, and I've written a lot about it, so I'll sort of keep it here, or keep it sort of at the level. The problem in this debate is that the debate's often happening for other reasons. That it's not about elections and accuracy, that it's about voter suppression. And that's why it's a hard debate to have. I mean, the debate about how the machine should be counted should happen before the vote. Right? I mean, you see this in the Democratic primary and how the delegates should be counted and how the rules should work. This is the wrong time to have this discussion, right? You have it before the first primary people, right? Before anybody has another agenda. Right? At the point where everybody wants accuracy, you hammer out the rules. And there should be a moratorium on talking about the rules until after the event. And then when nobody cares again, you talk about the rules. Otherwise, you know, and there are lots of good arguments on all sides. But the arguments aren't being made because they're right. They're being made because they're coming from the particular side. And that just screws the whole process.
As I listen to you, I'm in almost total agreement with your observation.
Excellent.
Actually, not.
Damn it.
It's you're making me profoundly pessimistic as I think about the agendas of the stakeholders in this society at this point in time. There are whole industries, powerful, wealthy industries, who have an agenda to motivate fear, to exacerbate our fear, only so they can sell to us a model that may act as a placebo.
You do remember the Cold War, don't you?
Pardon me?
You do remember the Cold War.
Sadly, I remember it.
So it's not, this isn't a new thing.
And in an emotional sense, I think both of us would agree the Cold War never ended. The boogeyman has changed.
Right, right.
From Stalin to at the moment Osama bin Laden. But the military industry is one of the industries, but I mean, it's as simple as the over-the-counter pharmaceutical industry that you've cited. You create the sense that all of us share certain aches and pains. And in a hypochondriac sense, we all say, well, everybody else has these little aches and pains, I must too. And then you go out and buy a pill that may in fact be snake oil, but shazam, that ache and pain goes away. In any event, with all of the powerful motives that people have in our society to motivate our fears, how can we possibly move in your direction of models that are reality-based?
So I'm not a pessimist, even though I have all the information I just shared with you, because in general, the system works. The system does tend to converge on reality. Right? We have been dealing with these problems, for a long time, since the beginning of society, on large and small scales, and we've managed, that the risks of driving, we all drive. You could sort of imagine automobiles showing up today and the warnings would be all over the cars and what people couldn't do and you couldn't drive over 20 miles an hour. I mean, that's what we saw in the beginning of cars. I mean, there were laws that you haven't had to walk in front of the car swinging a lantern before the car because it was so dangerous. But, we get used to the technology and we normalize it. And again, with all of the snake oil on prescription drugs, the drugs are actually, by and large, making us safer and making us more healthy. I mean, a lot of problems around the edges, but the systems largely work. It takes time. I mean, for terrorism today, we're living in the silly season. Right? We're living in the season where 100 years from now, people look back and laugh. They built a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. What were they thinking? Right? They'll say they try to take away liquids and screen shoes. And they'll put up the pictures and we'll have a good laugh about it. And I do think that'll happen. But it does take time. And it could be sloppy. Right? There could be lots of problems and lots of deaths. I mean, the Cold War in many parts of the planet ran pretty hot. So I tend to be short-term pessimistic and long-term optimistic. Because we as a species are surprisingly good at being social. And when you start working in security, you always see the bad stuff. You always see the criminals and the people trying to sell you snake oil and the bad public policy. But really, to a first approximation, people are honest. Because if they weren't, society wouldn't survive. Right? You walk into a restaurant. You can eat and not pay. You just run out after you eat. Right? As a security guy, how could you allow this? Well, it turns out most people don't do that. Most people try to do the right thing, try to do the smart thing. So there is, in society, a natural convergence of those things. Because that's how people survive.
Except if only one sociopath out of 1,000 people who are basically trying to do the right thing acts on opportunity, the consequences are so magnified in this society.
And that's the leverage issue, and certainly worth discussing. I'm not convinced it's that bad, and we've seen lots of single individuals do all sorts of horrible things in our planet, or oversee horrible things. And that's not going away. Right. The question you're asking is whether the noise of the system will sort of overcome the natural movement of society. Right. The 10 men question: how much damage can 10 men do? Right. When 10 men, and if it's not now, it's in 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 500 years, when they can sort of take out a planet, right, then it's a big deal. So yeah, I mean, those things are worth thinking about. I'm not convinced it's as bleak as that. But certainly these are discussions that we should have now about future technologies. And you've seen societies do very strange things, right? You saw feudal Japan give up the gun. The guns were introduced in their society by Westerners, and they said, whoa, this is going to really disrupt our way of living. We're not going to use guns. And they decided, as a society, not to use guns. And it stuck for a long time. And people do surprising things. That even though you have a tragedy of the commons problem. I didn't convince you. It's all right.
We've got a legitimate need in society.
Who's speaking? There you go. Sorry.
For to be able to prove identity, and the proposal for real ID seems to be out there to scratch that itch, but I'm really anxious that it isn't worth the cost that it's going to end up for future risks. Could you comment on that?
It's not. It's a long conversation. I mean, the answer question is like a half-hour answer, so I just assume not get into it. I've done a lot of writing on real ID and ID cards. Actually had a piece in the Star Tribune, I guess, about a month ago. If you go to my website at schneier.com, type real ID into the search window, you'll pull up longer essays I've done. I've done congressional testimony on it, which talks about, very real, how it works, what it does, what it costs, the trade-offs, really building a model of identification and then deciding where it makes sense and where it doesn't. So I sort of urge you to read that rather than me giving you a half-assed answer. So I think that'd be better. So I think you are the last question because we have to do our next thing.
Lucky me.
So you have to be a good question.
Oh, I promise.
You will be judged by your peers on the quality of your question.
So now I guess that's the question of how secure I feel.
You can pass the mic. I don't mind.
I guess I just wanted to go back, and if you could just comment a little bit, because you mentioned the role of society and our connection to a society. And over the last few years, there's been more and more talk, the whole bowling alone phenomenon, right? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, if you feel it does connect to this sense of the model of security moving further away from reality. This idea that we as a nation feel more isolated from one another.
I mean, it's certainly true that people who tend to be alone have wackier ideas, right? There's sort of fewer people saying, that's dumb, just relax, right? I really haven't studied the effects of isolation on feeling of security. And it's a really interesting question. I'm not convinced that we as society are much more alone. The definition of society and together in groups are changing. And there's certainly an effect due to, internet-based groups based on interests, that there is a much bigger echo chamber, that people are less likely to see other ideas if they only talk to people who think the way they do. I think that's something we have to think about. But I'm not convinced that that's a real problem yet. I mean, it certainly could be. I mean, in politics, it seems to be two sets of reality in this country. And they're completely different. I mean, they're different. You sort of go read the other side, whichever side you're on. And they, have different news. It's a different world, and different things are important. And the same events happen completely differently. So I think that does affect things, right? Because we have a bifurcation of models. And that isn't good, right? I mean, I want a singular model. I mean, I want a world where the experts are listened to whether you like what they say or not, right? They're experts. That's why you got them. This whole, we'll get our own experts, right? The kind of thing, the smoking industry did. Right? I don't think helps us at all. But it's an interesting observation that people being isolated might actually exacerbate this issue. I think there's some truth in that. Because if you're not in a group, your feelings can diverge. Right? A group tends to move people towards a norm. You want to have the same feelings as your group. I mean, lots of weird experiments, show how important it is to be a member of a group. There's a great experiment done where there's a people in a row at a table. They're all measuring something with a ruler. And the first five are part of the experiment, and the only last one's a subject. And the first five measure the thing wrong, exactly the same way, then wildly wrong. Right? They take a foot-long ruler, and the thing is 7 inches, and they say it's a foot. And they pass it, and everyone does it. The last guy says it too. It's amazing. And you can see this on video. And they struggle with it sometimes, or they don't, but they say it. Right? So there is a very strong need in humans to be part of the group, to think the same. Right? And that tends to weed out the extremists. So I mean, I'm just sort of making this up as I go, but I think I think that's something worth looking at. And probably, I bet if I read Bowling Alone, and I know the book, I would read it with sort of with this in mind, and I would come up with a better opinion. So thanks much. There's a reception in some mysterious place.
Thank you, Bruce. Very interesting. Very valuable. There's lots more to talk about outside, and Michelle from the Humphrey just wants to make an announcement before we leave.
For those of you who are alumni of the Institute, please help yourselves. We're going to open the doors here to the food, but come to back to the front table. So we're going to pick our prizes for Institute alumni. Make sure you get your name in there.
Could you hear? If you're a member of the Humphrey Alumni Association, meet at the back table, and you're going to pick prizes. And everyone come out and enjoy the food and wine and other beverages.